One of the characteristics of this book that that makes it seem as if it belongs in a lifestyle reading list, in spite of the fact that the lady is 80. And she's certainly, you know, far beyond your age. Not so far beyond mine, but far beyond yours. I would just like to have you, even if you haven't read the whole thing, you've read enough of it, I'm sure, to know what it's about and what she deals with. And anybody is free to. Is this too breezy
for you?
No, it's not too breezy for me, but I wondered if it gets too cold, will you push that up, somebody? Just feel free to close the window. All right? Somebody tell me, what do you think this book has going for itself that makes it a legitimate book on a lifestyle list? What is she talking about?
It would be helpful when we all get together for a geriatric reunion.
Pardon me?
It would be helpful when we all get together for a geriatric reunion.
All right, that's right. Very good for a geriatric reunion. Around about, you know, something like 60 years. What is she talking about?
Her passion at
80 shames me at 30. Yeah, her passion at 80 shames me at 30. Well, that's an honest statement, John. What does she discuss? Who is she in this book?
That's what she's discussing.
Pardon me?
That who is she, and what is it to live?
Exactly. Absolutely. She's talking about who am I and what does it mean to live? Now, what does that have to do with a lifestyle study? Has it got anything to do with lifestyle? Well, of course it has something to do with your lifestyle. if the person is concerned about about living, that's what lifestyle is about. It's the style of your life, right? Finally, you get it out. I feel like Socrates being a midwife and pulling it out. But,
I think that was the
there are two main streams that run through the book. One of them is her concern with the individual, herself, her own relationship with herself, with the world, and then her concern about the individual is related to others. And Paul is just taking the plastic off the windows.
He's turning the discussion hard way.
Yes, he is. We could invite him in, but you know, he's just the working class. You can't let him get ideas about himself.
He's the guy who's trying to go down and let him down to the roof.
Yes, right. He needs a group to at least let him through the plastic. The two strong motifs or themes that run through the book are the problem of the individual and the problem of the individual and others. That is the real sort of the crowd, the neighbor, the family, whatever. Those are the two big streams that run through this. And in the process of it, she manages to somebody else to do it. She's simply describing her own experience, and in a sense it goes on and challenges you and me to do the same thing, to be aware of yourself as a person, that you are a conscious individual in which and you deal with problems, you enter into problems, and you don't just let somebody else make up your mind for you on every score. At the bottom of page 7, she said, she talks about why she started a notebook. She said she used to, when I was sewing or playing a soothing, boring game of Patience, which is a card game, I found queries going round and round in my head, and I began to jot them down in this notebook, which I used to use for sketching. The queries were insistent, and I began a game of asking questions and giving answers. Answers out of what I had read and forgotten, and now thought my own, or out of my recoils and hopes. If the modern world is this, then will it become so-and-so? Now, really, what she's doing is helping you to see this is the way, you know, some thinking can develop in your mind. You know, you ask yourself a question. Now, how do I answer that question? I mean, it doesn't have to be in a geometric question. It doesn't have to be an actual posed question about such a person or such an event. But to try to deal with an abstraction, even. And it really, you know, it really does make you think, well, now, that is a thought process that she's describing. She said the queries were insistent, and I began a game of asking questions and giving answers. Answers out of what I'd read and forgotten, and so on. If the modern world is this, then will it become so-and-so? Now, you may say, well, I don't need to ask that question because, you know, if it's going to become so-and-so, so what? You know, I wouldn't have anything to do with it. But you see, for a person for whom thinking is an important factor, if human beings are made to think, then you haven't any real right to say, it doesn't make any difference what I think about it. I'm not going to alter it. That's not the important thing. The important thing is that you actually face the problem on my mind. What matters is what I have now. What, in fact, I live and feel. Now, this is a totally subjective approach to any kind of thinking and any kind of problem. And yet, you have to remember that she also is a person who has put a lot of reading in the abyss she calls the mind. And so a lot of that is going to come up to the top. And you may not be conscious of remembering everything, but it's there. And it forms and helps you to form a clear thinking on some particular question. It makes my notebook my dear companion or my undoing. I put down my sweeping opinions, prejudices, limitations, and just here the book fails me, for it makes no comment. And I think this is one of the first little indications you have of her understanding of herself as a solitary individual. And that being a solitary individual is, as Kierkegaard said, this is, you know, every single person has to see himself as a solitary. You've got to see yourself as an individual. And then you have to see yourself, as she develops later, and in and out amongst all the pages of the notebook, the relationship with the community, and the fight against the crowd mentality, and the sense of being tied to one's family, all these things that threaten the solitary individual, and yet, on the other hand, the solitary individual needs it. You can't be just a solipsism. You can't just live in your own isolated selfness, because you have to be in relationship with other people. But and I think that one of the wonderful little humane touches in this, human being touches, I'd say, in this, is what she says right below that on page 8 in the middle. I'm getting fine and supple from the mistakes I've made, but I wish a notebook could laugh. Old and alone, one lives at such a high moral level. One is surrounded by eternal verity, noble austerities, to scale on every side, and frightening depths of insight. It is inhuman. I long to laugh. I want to be enjoyed. But an hour's talk and I'm exhausted. But you know, this you see the kind of ambivalence here of the contrast of the person who senses the unreality of being the isolated individual. That what you can figure everything out, and Kierkegaard did a good job on this, you know, that it's important for the individual to stand before God and realize that God is really dealing with you and me individually. He's not going to deal with us en masse or as a church or as a nation. He's going to deal with everybody, and he does deal with everybody individually. And yet you know, when you're living that way, you live in an absolute. And living, you can't live totally by absolutes. If you've tried it, you know it's impossible. And the very fact that she brings in this statement that it's inhuman. I long to laugh. I want to be enjoyed. I want to have a response from somebody. Is part of the human cry of even someone who's fighting desperately to retain his individuality, his personhood, that he's fighting to keep his independence, so he is not influenced by the group and formed by the group. And yet, at the same time, you need the group. Now, that's a real paradox, isn't it? And yet, that's the way human life is. It's very much that way. And she makes it very clear what this is. Her whole style of life of writing is probably summed up in a way in page 9 where she says, to include and condone is modern, while to differentiate is old-fashioned. The importance of defining, of making differences, of showing where the differences are, as she says, it's old-fashioned, but it's important that we differentiate, because we've got to be able to define and understand the what makes one thing different from another. And as she says, the problem is, what a perilous morality. Will humanity ever be equal to it? The problem of living as an individual in a shifting society and somehow maintaining your standards and yet relating to this continual flux that society is. Where will the difference lie between the man who blindly lives his chaos and the man who consciously endures the conflict between the opposing sides of his nature? The latter will gain clarity, a deepened awareness, and he will achieve responsibility for many aspects of his being. But much of the time, the two men will look the same. So on the outside, you know, and this is very much like the wheat and the tares that Jesus talks about, and the fact that you can't really tell always from looking at people which person is really struggling with life and which person is just, as she says, blindly living all his chaos. Living like a dog, living like an animal, just following his instincts. I mean, what? You can't always see that on people, fortunately. But the important thing is that you know that you're willing to enter into this kind of a struggle to understand truth, and to understand truth for yourself. She has a wonderful... Pardon me? Well, I guess so. On page 13, I don't know how many of you have finished this book, by the way? Remember this, on page 13, the one about the weaving? It's marvelous. I think we ought to put this up. Somebody ought to letter this and put it up in the weaving room. I used to draw, absorbed in the shapes of roots of trees and seed pods and flowers, but it strained my eyes and I gave it up. Then, 10 years ago, I began to make rugs. A few were beautiful, though never straight. This gives me a great deal of courage. This gave them vitality, as I created patterns, banged and pulled, the wool and I struggling, the wool winning sometimes. At great moments, I in full command. My heart knew peace, and my mind was as empty as a cloudless sky on a summer's day. But my hands were too arthritic. It had to end. And now only music prevents my facing my thoughts. Now, maybe you don't think that music is an escape, but for Flora Scott Maxwell, she knew what she was talking about. She did her weaving because it was a great therapy, and we all know that. You know, doing something like that is a great, you know, it's a wonderful kind of thing. Sometimes some people can beat out problems while they're doing that, but most of us have to concentrate on what's going on in the loom. And that means that you don't get, you know, you're not bogged down with a lot of problems for a while. You really have a rest while you're really, as she says, sometimes the wool is winning and sometimes she does. But then she got too arthritic, and now the only thing that prevents her from facing her thoughts is music. How many of you realize how much music is in our, in our society today? This taped music that goes, like in Minneapolis where we live, it comes down the mall. I don't know why, and I think it's in some parts of L.A., and I know that in many doctor's offices and dentist's offices, well, I can see some point in that. In dentist's offices, you really don't want to face your thoughts in the dentist's office. But you realize that the real, that's a real problem, I think, that we just feel like we've got to have something on all the time, and it stops us from being the individual in solitude. You know, if you've got music on, you can kind of cushion it a little bit. Now, Paul Lund and I were talking about the fact that a lot of times good music is a help because it blocks out a lot of other noise, and so you can really, you know, you can concentrate on what you have to concentrate on, especially in koinonia. But she's thinking of it more in terms of an actual willed kind of thing, you know, in which you really are trying to get out of having to face yourself and your thoughts. And so you can kind of dream yourself along on some, you know, a good sonata or a quartet or something. And this is, you know, you have to be aware of this. And then she says, age puzzles me. I thought it was a quiet time. My 70s were interesting and fairly serene, but my 80s are passionate. I grow more intense as I age. To my own surprise, I burst out with hot conviction. Reminds me of your grandmother, Becky. You know, I don't think she ever will, you know, quiet down. Do you?
Hot conviction, no.
Only a few years ago, I enjoyed my tranquility. Now I am so disturbed by the outer world and by human quality in general that I want to put things right as though I still owed a debt to life. I must calm down. I'm far too frail to indulge in moral fervor. I think that's a great little. I mean, doesn't it make you feel like, you know, getting old isn't going to be all that bad? No, I really dislike the idea that somehow getting old is a kind of incarceration in, you know, in a lot of, you know, a beautiful garden and a grandmother that sits and nods her head like this, you know. Of course, dear. Well, but it's something my father said once about people in jobs. And he said if they're alive when they're young, they're going to be alive when they're old. He said if they never did get to be alive, he said, you know, you might as well forget it. They're never going to make it to 60 or 70. Of course, they're going to be kicked out of whatever they're doing because they aren't excited with the passion of ideas because they never had them. And so, you know, they were old before they started. Now this is one of the first times when you see her desire to move from the individual specifically to the group. And she says, we are open to our own sentience. And by sentience, she's talking about your feeling, your self-awareness, what C.S. Lewis calls conskiering, the consciousness. You're open to this. We can't get away from it, and it is too much. We should ward off the problematic and above all the insoluble. These are far, far too much, but it is just these that attract us. Our one safety is to draw in and enjoy the simple and immediate. We should rest within our own confines. It may be dull, restricted, but it can be satisfying within our own walls. I feel most real when alone, even most alive when alone. Better to say that the liveliness of companionship and the liveliness of solitude differ. And the latter is never as exhausting as the former, and that's for sure. You know, you may get be utterly alone and feel really depressed, but it isn't quite as exhausting as the liveliness of companionship, in which you have to continually relate and argue and declare and define and so on. When I am with other people, I try to find them, or try to find a point in myself from which to make a bridge to them. Or, and this is a beautiful little phrase, or I walk on the eggshells of affection, trying not to hurt or misjudge. Marvelous little, you know, turn of the phrase. All this is very tiring, but love at any age takes everything you've got, which, take it from me, is true. And then she talks about a mother and the problem, the difficulty that mothers have in relating to their families and how they want to protect them and how hard it is to finally, you know, let them go and realize that these children are, you know, indeed have to be on their own. You can't hold on to them. Even if, she says, even a mother's love for her children, even her inability to let them be, is because she's under a painful law that the life that passed through her must be brought to fruition. Even when she swallows it whole, she's only acting like any frightened mother cat, eating its young to keep it safe. Age is truly a time of heroic helplessness. One is confronted by one's own incorrigibility. I'm always saying to myself, look at you, and after a lifetime of trying. That's on page 17. I still have the vices that I've known and struggled with, well, it seems like since birth. Many of them are modified, but not much. I can neither order nor command the hubbub of my mind. Or is it my nervous sensibility? This is not the effect of age. Age only defines one's boundaries. Age only defines one's boundaries. Life has changed me greatly. It's improved me greatly, but has also left me practically the same. I cannot spell. I am overcritical, egocentric, and vulnerable. I cannot be simple, and that's true. She is not an easy person to read. This is a much better book than the book that I discussed yesterday. I think I read that book 3 or 4 times to try to get it clear in my head what she was talking about, because every time I thought that I had a sentence straight, I'd go back and say, no, that isn't what she said at all. She's not clear. In my effort to be clear, I become complicated. I know my faults so well that I pay them small heed. They are stronger than I am, and they are me. And then she talks about the problem of the I that is in her. And she says, but who is it that knows me so well and has to endure me? There is the I that has to bear all the other I's and can assess them correctly. And there is the I who feels such sick distaste and drunken elation at being itself, all itself, who is even thankful for the opportunity of having been itself, uncomfortable as it has been. And then she goes on to say, you know, this is a real problem. I mean, who am I? You know, I've got all these people inside of me. Maybe you don't have that trouble. I mean, you know, you're just one clear person, you know, don't have any conflict.
What word is
vapid? I don't know, is it? Vapid? Did you say?
Yeah.
That you don't have more than one?
Yeah.
Well, that could be. My curiosity, delight, pain tell me about life itself. This makes me a monster of egotism. But that is what I am and have to be, for how else do I know, really know anything? I observe others, but I experience myself. And then she's...
Stop this.
What?
No.
In terms of, you know, articulation.
Mm-hmm.
In simple speech, he might get the sentence like that, observe others to experience myself. It's one of those trump sentences that's said in words that there's no way of agreeing, and it somehow captures so much you can unpack that.
That's right. That's true.
Days.
Mm-hmm.
I remember that when I first read this, I just remember that talking to you.
Mm-hmm.
In the sense of wanting to go off, you know, wanting to go off and unpack this in poem.
Mm-hmm.
You know, years.
Because it is true.
So it's magnificent. Simple statement, and then she gets to, you know, in a given paragraph, she gives you, you know, five of them.
And that's where she says, you know, that when she tries to be clear, she becomes complicated. And it's true that all the things that she says, and that's why so often you have to reread it. And it isn't that it's such great literature. It's just that as she says, I try to be clear and then I become complicated. But it's worth going back over it, because when she does hit one of these sentences, as John says, they're real trunk statements from which the trees really branches out in limbs of all kinds and really flowers. I observe others, but I experience myself. And then she says, if I am myself with ardor, and no other way seems possible, I am also helpless in my own grasp. Now, this is what she means by living passionately. And how many of you saw Equus? You know, the only problem with Equus is that it identifies passion, at least superficially, with sex only. I mean, you kind of feel like that's where a lot of it is illustrated. And yet, it's deeper than that, because it's in the whole conviction that life, if it's going to be lived, has to be lived passionately. You can't live observing life. If you do, you're not going to live it. And this is why, when she says, I observe others, but I experience myself, and she says, I am myself with ardor. Now, do you know what ardor means? You know that means with fire, with passion, with a real burning kind of a commitment and love. And yet she asks, but she says, I'm also helpless in my own grasp. And if this ought to give all of us some comfort, in spite of the fact that, we may feel like, what's the use of struggling with all this? Because obviously here she is 80 and she hasn't gotten anywhere. No. that's just, you know, that's just like people will say, you know, well, you know, how come you've been a Christian for all these years and you really haven't improved that much? You know, and as if that were why you are a Christian. You know, it's also the whole thing with her living, you know, it's going to be miserable, it's going to be struggle, it's going to be passion, I'm not going to be able to come to real clarity. And why don't I just live my chaos blindly, as she says? Why don't I live like a dog and just follow my instincts? Why do I let the challenge of being a human being weigh on me so that I actually have to live it? She says, I observe and reflect, yet when I'm asked for an opinion, I feel part of a network. I'm not a solid point. I'm very nearly absent. It amounts to this, that near the end of my life, when I am myself as never before, I am awareness at the mercy of multiplicity. I am awareness at the mercy of multiplicity. And you don't know what that's like yet, because you are young and you don't have quite as many impressions made on you as I've had. But it is true that this is almost the way you get so frustrated, because there's so many things not only that you want to do, but that you want to clear up for yourself, and you feel like you've got all the stuff that goes into the actual solution of the problem. And yet, you know, you've got another, then you get a whole, as she says in the next line, ideas drift in like bright clouds, arresting, momentary, they come as visitors. A shaft of insight can enter the back of my mind, and when I turn to greet it, it is gone. I did not have it. It had me. My mood is light and dancing, or it is leaden. It is not I who choose my moods. I accept them, but from whom? I mean, you see her, what a wonderful thing to have a woman of 80 who's still asking questions. You know, she didn't have it made. Now, maybe people think it's better and say yes, don't differ, it's not safe. That's the comfortable way to be, but that's not what she's going to do. And she talks about the problem of the fight between the individual and the tribe as being a continuous battle in order to understand who you are. Just by the way, I'm sure some of you remember this from when you read it, but I really too, she does intersperse such fun things in the midst of the more profound discussions. She said, as I do not live in an age when rustling black silk skirts billow about me, and I do not carry an ebony stick to strike the floor in sharp rebuke, as this is denied me, I rap out a sentence in my notebook and feel better. If a grandmother wants to put her foot down, the only safe place to do it these days is in her notebook. Better keep that in mind. I think that's very good. And then right after that, she has this big, long discussion on the problem of the tribe, that society is tribal, humanity is tribal, and the fact that protective oneness that you see everywhere and know is deeply essential to each of us. Perhaps primitives are less closely held together than I assume, but their unchanging ways over long periods must imply the existence of very few people individual enough to differ from the group or strong enough to establish their difference. Perhaps many do differ, but wisely conceal it, since it is the most uncomfortable thing in the world to stand alone. The most uncomfortable thing in the world to stand alone. The ordeal of being true to your own inner way must stand high in the list of ordeals. And that's true. And I think her whole concern with on this other side, the individual, and then the tribe or the mass, which is sort of the sounding board, is developed very, very fully. That you have this sense of the tribe, you have this sense of undifferentiation. That it's so much easier to be like everybody else, and that perhaps that's the way. Maybe that's. Answers our deepest instincts, but does it answer the human being instinct? You know, maybe that answers your deepest instinct as way back in your evolutionary prehistoric days, but does it answer the instinct of the breath of life of God himself? You know, is that the instinct, just to be like everybody else? You remember what Dante says, what Beatrice says in the paradise, how the closer you get to God, the more the differences are, the greater the differences are. And what a lot of multiplicity of people there are in the cities of heaven. Now, you see, you remember what we said about Lewis? He said, humanity never leaves anything behind. It carries everything with it. So, you know, it was just a few days ago that we discussed Lewis, and just last week that we discussed Dante. Now, don't forget it. See, I mean, you have to carry this along with you, that these things have relationships with each other, that her concern of the individual and the tribe is the same concern that you have psychologically in Dante, with the concern that the individual, the closer it gets to God, does not lose its identity, it affirms its identity. It affirms its differences. And you know, you start putting things together, even if they aren't in books together, and nobody ever said they were. But that's your business. You You know, it's your business to pick them up and put them together, because what Dorothy Sayers talked about in The Lost Tools of Learning was the tragedy of people not knowing how to move from one subject to another, or make the kind of comparisons or syntheses between one area and another, one book and another, one field and another, that you know how to move from one thing to another. You're not rigid, and because it wasn't in the book that way, oh, I don't think that's right. I wouldn't dare to say that. But this is important, that you see, you know, you see the, you recognize similarities that go across the centuries and across nations and worlds and oceans, and, you know, they have a lot to do with each other, because the human being has no boundaries, really. You know, really doesn't. The individual, is it the individual whose fate it is to oppose the mass, to succor the nascent value? The individual is the carrier of value by which we live. But what if we forget this? What if the crowd becomes too strong? What happens then? Can the hero, the ordinary man, of course, I mean, the ordinary man is the hero. You know, he's not somebody that you pluck out of the this is on page 22. Can the hero, the ordinary man, of course, rise to the height that will be required of him? Or is he going to be completely overwhelmed by the mass mind? A man once said to me, I don't mind your telling me my faults. They're stale. But don't tell me my virtues. When you tell me what I could be, it terrifies me. I was surprised then. I understand now. Because I believe we may be faced by the need of living our strengths. And I think this is, you know, I think this is true. You don't mind being ripped into for all the stuff you don't do. But if people suddenly start saying, look, you've got this or that gift or talent, and what are you doing with it? Hiding it under a bushel. You're burying it in the ground. And you feel threatened. You don't want to do that. It jerks you out of your laziness. Yeah, that's true. If truth is measured by numbers, it being assumed that what the majority want is good and must be, then my wild heart, my now wild heart that never used to be wild, or if it was, didn't know it, did not indeed benefit by it, flames for the truth of the few. We choose many things by a tribal truth, many more than we like. But, and here's where she says, you know, this is where the human being really asserts itself. But there is a truth in the very pit of one's being that opposes tribal good. In other words, the rebel has a value and a validity for society that is, you know, instinct with his human beingness. I don't know how many of you have read any of the dialogues of Socrates, the early dialogues. They're really very interesting. And I remember one of the statements that Socrates finally, as a proof to one of the men that he was questioning and answering with, that the way you can tell whether something is true or not is whether the majority has voted for it. If the majority has voted for it, you can be quite sure that it's mostly untruth.
Oh.
Okay. Yeah. That the test of truth is the fact that only the minority will really accept it. Now you better bat that around a little bit. It doesn't work in a democratic society, I might say, but when you get to real truth where you have to lay yourself on the line, is the majority going to do that? Is the majority going to want to sacrifice itself for truth? Well, you know it doesn't. You know? The majority is always concerned about the greatest good for the greatest number, and usually it's the greatest good in the most mediocre form. It gets lower and lower and lower so that it can be a common denominator at the lowest point. And it demands nothing of anybody.
you're doing it to them.
Mm-hmm. Right. And she has this first, there's the first little clue of where the book is going to go, although it was not written with the idea of it being a testament of faith. But on page 24 and 25, she says, how understandable that most of our beliefs protect us from the danger of being an individual. Think of others, we were once taught. Adapt, adapt, we are now told. But it is a coward cry, for he who, after cruel buffeting, wins to aloneness, learns that life is a tragic mystery. We are pierced and driven by laws we only half understand. We find that the lesson we learn again and again is that of accepting heroic helplessness. Some uncomprehended law holds us at a point of contradiction where we have no choice. Where we do not like that which we love, where good and bad are inseparable partners, impossible to tell apart, and where we, heartbroken and ecstatic, can only resolve the conflict by blindly taking it into our hearts. This used to be called being in the hands of God. Has anyone any better words to describe it? It's on page 25. You should underline it. I get so taken up looking at all the things that I want you to be sure to look at in the book that I get carried away. But I'm so afraid we might miss some of them. So I'm going to have you turn to some other quotes in here. Those of you who have your books with you, there's a very good little one on page 28. My kitchen linoleum is so black and shiny that I waltz while I wait for the kettle to boil. This pleasure is for the old who live alone. The others must vanish into their expected role. I know what that's like. Really wonderful thing when you're all by yourself, you can dance around and do as you please, and nobody's going to look at you and think, what kind of illusions of grandeur does she have, you know? Really, really true. And then right below that, all those who through history have helped life to enlarge, to diversify, at their peril, always at their peril, have been strongly individual. Now, just remember this, always at their peril. This is why the mass and the majority can never vote for an absolute truth, because they can't vote peril to themselves. You see? The individual can, but the mass can't. Above all, the greatest, who was more than a man. And it's just a hint there, you know, to whom she's referring. Then on page 35, well, she has one on 31 that's great about, so many of these are things that you, the book has to be read savor, not just, you know, pluck little truths out here and there. You have to understand the taste of it and the beauty of the way in which the tapestry weaves itself back and forth. Another day to be filled, to be lived silently, watching the sky and the lights on the wall. No one will come, probably. I have no duties except to myself. That is not true. I have a duty to all who care for me, not to be a problem, not to be a burden. I must carry my age lightly for all our sakes, and thank God I still can. Oh, that I may to the end. You know, it's really kind of neat, you know, her feeling of sort of the obligation of being a woman in old age who carries her age lightly, that she's not going to be a problem for people. And yet, you know, she does have a problem, as you remember. When she talks about her, she says, we carry through as in old age, in silent, hot rebellion, we cry silently, I've lived my life, haven't I? What more is expected of me? Have we got to pretend out of noblesse oblige that age is nothing in order to encourage the others? This we do with a certain haughtiness, realizing now
that we reached a place beyond resignation, a place I had no idea existed until I had arrived here. It's a place of fierce energy. Perhaps passion would be a better word than energy. This is 32, page 32. If I try to transpose it, for the sad fact is this vivid life cannot be used. This is the real tragedy and frustration of this kind of passionate quality in life as you get old, and yet, and you know, all this passion, it's going to be spent for nothing. Nobody's going to listen to you. You don't have any profound truths that anybody's going to pay any attention to. And if I try to transpose it into action, I'm soon spent. It has to be accepted as passionate life, perhaps the life I never lived, never guessed I had it in me to live. Isn't that amazing, you know, to think of a woman in her 80s, you know, describing her life as having a whole new dimension to it now in her 80s, something she never thought she had in her 50s or 40s or 30s. And then on page 34, impossible to speak the truth until you have contradicted yourself. It's really quite important. And then a wonderful little, that whole paragraph is good as she moves into her relationship with her friends, and she says, I dwell with the essence of friends so intensely that when they arrive, I can be paralyzed by the astonishing opacity of their actual presence. When you're away from people, you're so aware of who they are. They seem so clear. And then suddenly, they come in their bodily form, and you know, you realize you can't look right through them anymore. They're not that, their essences aren't that available to you. And she's able to really get it. I love this on page 36. When a new disability arrives, I look about to see if death has come. And I call quietly, "Death, is that you? Are you there?" So far, the disability is answered, "Don't be silly, it's me." Like arthritis or, you know, what have you. And here again, she talks about a lot about the individual, about the importance of it. In the landscape of the impersonal, there was always the loved individual. It's a long stretch of time that gives us our viewpoint of that. We have watched generation follow generations, and we see the same qualities in grandparents, parents, and children working the same sad havoc. We saw the same wounds we see now caused in like manner long ago. We would like to warn and teach, but we've learned that it is almost useless. In the course of our lives, we have amassed too much data for sharp sorrow, and we have just as much reason for pity to have dulled who wants pity. So how carry it? And then she says, always through everything, I try to straighten my spine or my soul. This is page 39. They both ought to be upright, I feel, for pride, for style, for reality's sake. But both tend to bend as under a weight that's been carried a long time. I try to lighten my burden by knowing it. I try to walk lightly, and sometimes I do, for sometimes I feel both light and proud. At other times, I am bent, bent. And then, you know, right, the next paragraph. This morning when I woke and knew that I had had a fair night and that my pains were not too bad, I lay waiting for the uplifting moment when I pull back the curtains, see the sky, and I surprised myself by saying out loud, "My dear, dear days." And sort of like what Ron was saying the other night when he used that, "Ah, the joy of living." You know, that it is not, don't think that it's because you have to have lots of physical energy and lots of youth and overflow in order to sense even the physicality of life. And this is, you know, this is what she's concerned about. I think that when you read this over again yourselves, I think you might just sort of check the number of times she talks about the individual and the number of times she talks about the group or the mass. because that is, you may think this is just a book by an old lady, you know, and it's a nice, quiet thing to read. But just remember that the issues she addresses, the questions that she's asking, are worthy of a human being. They're just as important as any question you are able to ask, and probably far more profound. And so I would suggest that you go back over it and notice this, so that you realize that there's a lot more here than meets the eye, and particularly if you just sort of are reading through it rather, you know, to finish it and you really like it, but you'll find that the real depth of it will come to you only as you go back and actually try to understand what she's saying. It isn't that she's trying to write a philosophy or even a psychology of a human being in a certain age. She is writing her impressions in her notebook as she, you know, as she lives from one day to the next. And I think you could ask yourself if you would do as well, even now. It is the individual who can stand alone that can best relate to another person. It is he who can be true to a bond, and it is he who possesses a creative mind. This is page 52. This is her plea against this total equalization of society. Anyone who has become himself will respect himself for his difference, and so be respected by all. I don't think it's true that you're respected for that, but she said, but this is not equality. Only identical things are equal, and nature is incapable of repeating herself, great artist that she is. So what is the cry for equality, and what will it bring? We are different, not equal. So we suffer and compete, rise and fall, lose and achieve ourselves. We're truly the vehicles of evolution because under stress, we make a decisive choice that creates change enforced by necessity. Necessity can be cruel, and any generous heart and just mind tries to control the inequalities of circumstance. Great good can come from greater equality, less suffering, a flowering of new talent, new pride, increase in understanding. But there's also a danger now seen in Wade. It is the decrease of individuality on a large scale. This is what happens. And now this is a, talk about basic youth conflicts. I don't think they know what they're talking about, these people. I mean, basic conflicts are the conflicts that have to do with the things that she's talking about. That can you really say that it's less suffering, more good for more people, and yet at the same time that the individual decreases? Now, is that what you want, or isn't it? And it's not an answer that's there. No, it's not an answer that's apparent. It's something you have to think about and suffer through. Unreal inequality can stimulate to action, but unreal equality seems to dissolve us and distort us. We tend to live at the collective level, undefined, unreal, because of claims in our nature that we have not fulfilled, because of differences we have evaded. This is recognized as a present danger, and the word depersonalized is used to describe it. Thoughtful writers in America dwell on the degree of emptiness reached there. Middle-aged couples are frightened, children afraid to be alone, only able to live by melting into their club and their neighbors. English analysts are burdened and baffled by what they call the non-ego patient, people who are not pathological, but who lack the ability to live their own lives, needing to be carried. It is understandable to assume that fewer differences would mean less suffering, but it's dangerous to create large numbers of people whose first claim is to avoid the inner struggle, the ordeal of self-discovery. And then she talks about the problem with modern permissiveness, which makes it difficult to tell good from bad, as though it were simpler to have no differences at all. And this something I felt, you know, got blurred, at least in my response to it yesterday when we were talking about roles, because if you want everything to be just exactly alike, very soon it's very boring and very tiresome. Now that it is uncertain when a fault is a fault, our vagueness increases. Add to evasion and uncertainty the fact that we tend to annul the heights and depths of experience. If we no longer seek the spirit, if love and relationship should become small because sexual experience has few barriers around it to mark it as important, if the sense of sin is no longer self-recognition, then where is the intensity of our humanity?
Barriers around it to mark it's important.
Mm-hmm.
Well,
that's page 54. The sexual experience has few barriers around it to mark it as important. That's really something. It's like we were talking about last night about with Charlene and Don, I think, about the why it's important in the village to have a strong liturgy, a liturgical worship in the winter, for example, up here, where it would be so easy to make it, you know, really cozy and casual and friendly and intimate. But, you know, there's something about a kind of a blurring, finally, so that then it has no meaning and no importance at all, because it's not marked out. There's something about marking something out and defining it and having barriers around it, in a sense, that is essential if life is going to be lived with a kind of not walking all over without any kind of definition, a kind of a wandering and a soaking up of experience for experience sake. Then she has a very good little statement here, I think, page 57. It is easier to be everyone rather than integrate diversity in yourself. But is the ease not paid for in human quality? In analysis, while never forgetting the degree of one's own incurability, one experiences eternal truths that give dignity to man. Is that a frequent experience today? just notice, when you read through this book again, notice how many questions he asks. And ask yourself, how many questions do I ask when I write in my notebook? Page 57, that same page at the bottom, she says, will necessity, which can be as good a taskmaster as analysis, teach us that we are contained in an order we do not understand? And how many will accept the discipline of the discovery? How many will accept the discipline of the discovery? Because that's implied in that kind of experience of understanding what that meant. And then on page 58, while equality is thought possible, even a basic right, I want to remember the stimulus and interest of inequality. At once I feel heartless, as though I might wound or dishonor someone who had had less than I. The degree of our lack naturally determines the keenness of our claim. Now, just notice how this thought process is moving. Do you know what she's asking here? John, what is she saying here? While equality is thought possible, even a basic right, I want to remember the stimulus and interest of inequality. At once I feel heartless. Why does she feel that? Why does she feel heartless about that?
Well, she would seem that she would be sanctioning inequality.
Yes, and what's that about inequality? I mean, from her point of view. I mean, she's been championing it. And then she says, but I feel heartless when I see this.
Well, because that's the great thing that's championed in this age.
Yes.
And there's so much that...
But from her own personal point of view, she says, I feel heartless as though I might wound or dishonor. What? Those of you who haven't had your books, look on page 58. What's she concerned about?
Can you read it again?
While equality is thought possible, even a basic right, I want to remember the stimulus and interest of inequality. At once I feel heartless, as though I might wound or dishonor someone who had had less than I. The degree of our lack naturally determines the keenness of our claim. I have lacked much, vital things, and the ache has spurred me to intense living. But isn't reality the rousing shock we all need? And do we not lose ourselves in pretense if the truth and tragedy of inequality is not accepted? If we could be equal, what would happen to reverence and compassion? Now, what's the problem here? What's the problem with inequality?